Hello, everybody, and welcome back. We are in chapter 31, only two more chapters to go, and we're done. So chapter 31 is the Cold War and decolonization. So this is from 1945 to 75, so this is a 30-year period. So let's go ahead and jump right in. Section 1, the Cold War, A, the United Nations. So after World War II, we see that the Western leaders come together, and they're perceiving that the Soviet Union is the center of a world revolutionary movement. So while Soviet leaders themselves felt surrounded by Western countries and their North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, that was founded in 1949, that the United Nations provided a venue for this face-to-face debate between the two sides in the Cold War. So Soviet Union was surrounded by these Western nations, and they felt very pressured, so the United Nations was a real helpful way for them to kind of, or the idea was for them to discuss things. Section 2. The United Nations was established in 1945, actually in California, in the United States, and it had a General Assembly, a Security Council, a full-time bureaucracy that was headed by the Security General and various agencies, and all the signatories, all the countries that signed up for it, of this charter, renounced war and territorial conquest. But in practice, really the United Nations was seldom able to like foretell or really quell or stop international conflicts. 3. At this time, the decolonization of Africa and Asia would greatly swell the size of the General Assembly, which began as an arena for expressing opinions and whose resolutions would or could carry great weight in the early years of the United Nations. But we see that with the influx of these new members, the General Assembly became more concerned with poverty, racial discrimination, and the struggle against imperialism than with the Cold War. And so the Western powers increasingly ignore the General Assembly. B, capitalism and communism. 1. So between 1944 and 1946, we do see that Western capitalist countries created new international monetary system, in which supply and demand ended up determining prices, and that included a system of exchange rates, an international monetary fund, and a world bank. So the Soviet Union, on the other hand, was very suspicious of these Western intentions and would establish a closed monetary system in which the state would allocate goods and set prices for itself and for the communist state of Eastern Europe. 2. The United States economy recovered and prospered hugely during and after World War II. The economy of Western Europe that was heavily damaged during World War II recovered during the post-war period with the help of the Marshall Plan from the United States. 3. Western European governments would launch and would increase their role in economic management during this period. And in 1948, we see Europeans create a process of economic cooperation and integration with the creation of the Organization of European Economic Cooperation. And this expanded its membership as it's developed into the European Economic Community, or the Common Market, in 1957, and then into the European Community in 1970. 4. The Soviet Union, on the other hand, and its Eastern European satellite states would rely on the government of Russia, or of the Soviet Union, to determine the production, the distribution, and the price of goods. So in the communist states, the recovery from World War II was rapid at first, but in the long run, the Soviet and those Eastern European economies were unable to match those of the West in the production of consumer goods, housing development, and of food. C. West versus East in Europe and Korea. 1. So the rapid establishment of communist regimes in Eastern Europe would lead the United States to perceive that the Soviet Union was a worldwide enemy. So the Soviet Union was an enemy to everybody. That's what America was portraying. So American perceptions would lead to the Truman Doctrine of 1947. and the establishment of NATO in 1949. So the Truman Doctrine was basically the idea that if any country is in need or is threatened by communism, the United States will be there to help them, whether it be through funding or aid or military power. The Americans would be there. That's what the Truman Doctrine was. And NATO is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. That is just North Atlantic countries came together and they are working together against communism. The Soviet Union responded to both these actions by organizing the Warsaw Pact in 1955. This was the consolidation and like the alliance, economic and political alliance of the Eastern Satellite Communist States and the USSR. So it was just the communist version of NATO, basically. Two, a third Great War did not break out in Europe, but the Soviet Union and the West did test each other's resolve in different instances, such as the Soviet bloc of West Berlin in 1948 and 1949. This would, in turn, cause the construction of the Berlin Wall in 1961. As well as the West's encouragement of the rift between Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union. This is also seen during the testing of the Berlin airlift, where the Soviet Union refused to allow provisions and things into the eastern side of Berlin, the eastern side of Germany. And so the Soviet power was used to ensure the obedience of Eastern European nations such as Hungary and Czechoslovakia. So they just increased their power in this region. Three. Now, while all this was going on in Korea, the Soviets and the Americans occupied different zones, north and south, of the 38th parallel. And this, the 38th parallel led to the establishment in 1948 of a communist North Korea and the non-communist South Korea. So North Korea's invasion of South Korea in 1950 marked the beginning of the Korean War, in which the United States came to the aid of South Korea while China, who was communist at this time, sent troops to assist the North. And it was not until a ceasefire in 1953 that the border was officially fixed again at the 38th parallel, but no peace treaty was concluded. So technically, still the Korean War has not officially ended because they only signed a ceasefire. So it's not a peace treaty. It hasn't technically ended. There still is technically a Korean War. That is why if you listen to any news outlets, the president of Korea or the leader, the supreme leader of North Korea and Trump are trying to sign something that officially ends the Korean War, because technically the Korean War is not over. D, U.S. defeat in Vietnam. One, so after winning independence from France, communist North Vietnam would support a communist guerrilla movement, or the Viet Cong, which was against the non-communist government of South Vietnam. So remember, France was the colonizer in Vietnam. Remember, that's when they called Vietnam Indochina, and it was an imperialist colony of France. This is the whole independent issue. So John F. Kennedy decided to send American military advisors to assist South Vietnam, and it was President Lyndon B. Johnson that would gain congressional support for unlimited expansion of U.S. military deployment. Two, so what ends up happening is the U.S. is unable to stop the Viet Cong and their North Vietnamese allies, and it ends its involvement in Vietnam in 1973, and the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese troops would take over South Vietnam in 1975, and it would become a communist country. It is still a communist country today. Three. The Vietnam War brought significant casualties to both sides, and it gave rise to serious economic problems and a huge anti-war movement in the United States. Members of the American military and their civilian supporters argued that government restrictions on American military operations had deprived the Americans of their chances for victory, and such restrictions were designated to prevent China from entering the war and possibly starting a nuclear confrontation. So the supporters of the war were saying that the Congress and the president didn't do enough, it was too restricting, they didn't have enough support over there, that's why they lost. E, the race for nuclear supremacy. One, So at this time, we had the existence of weapons of mass destruction that affected all aspects of the Cold War confrontation, and this would increase paranoia in the United States and spread fear of nuclear destruction throughout the world. And this fear of nuclear war seemed about to be realized, but not really, when the Soviet Union deployed nuclear missiles in Cuba in response to American deployment of missiles in Turkey. So it's always positive. So the whole situation of how the Cuban Missile Crisis began was because America started it, but you never learned that. But America started it by deploying missiles into Turkey, which is very, very close to the Soviet Union. So what if the Soviet Union do? Khrushchev only responded similarly and placed missiles close to the United States in Cuba. And the only reason that the United States knew about this was through a CIA agent who, through pictures of building of soccer fields in Cuba, sparked questions and inquiry by the CIA, because Cubans at that time didn't play soccer, they played baseball. So why are they building these soccer fields? So with further investigation, we see that the CIA found out that that's why, I mean, the Russians' involvement into creating these areas of being able to ship missiles into the region. So that's the only reason that they found that out. But this is all America's fault to begin with, because if they didn't put missiles in Turkey, then this whole crisis wouldn't have been started. Yet you don't learn that in regular history, because they don't want you to know that side of history. But anyway, Khrushchev would end up backing down and ultimately would withdraw the missiles from Cuba, and this is where we see the installation of the red phone line that directly connects the president, the U.S. president, to the premier of Russia, and that is still in use today, so the president can call the president of Russia from this phone line that was instituted right after the Cuban Missile Crisis. Two, so the number or the means of delivery and the force of nuclear weapons increased tremendously. But at the same time, the Soviet Union and the U.S. made some progress on arms limitations. So we do see in the 70s with the SALT treaties under Nixon and the kind of thawing of the Cold War under the Nixon administration, that after 1972, the superpowers began the slow process of negotiating weapons limitations. Three, so rather than attempting to keep up with the expensive arms race between the communists and the Americans, or the Soviets and the Americans, the European nations sought to kind of help relax tensions between East and West through organizations as the Conference on Security and the Cooperation in Europe. And these would lead to the signing of the Helsinki Accords. Four, space exploration was another kind of race or competition between the Soviets and the Americans, and just was another offshoot of that original nuclear arms race. And as the ability to launch satellites and send manned rockets into space was understood to signify equivalent achievements in the military sphere, so they were pretty much very, very similar, the Soviets and the United States. Section 2, decolonization and nation building. A, the new nations in South and Southeast Asia. 1. So, back in the last chapter when we talked about decolonization, after partition in 1947 between Pakistan and India, there were a lot of dissimilarities between the two. So, India and Pakistan ended up dividing, remember, because the predominantly large Muslim population of northern India and the predominantly large Hindu population of southern India divided themselves and became two sovereign nations. Two, Pakistan would end up defining itself in terms of religion, and this fell under the control of military leaders and saw its Bengali-speaking eastern section secede, and this little section became the independent nation of Bangladesh in 1971. India was a secular republic with a 90% Hindu population, and it inherited a larger share of the industrial and educational resources, and it was able to maintain unity despite the linguistic differences of the population. You know, people spoke different languages even within India. 3. So in Southeast Asia, we see that the defeat that the Japanese had inflicted on the British, French, and Dutch in World War II would set an example of an Asian people standing up to those European colonizers. And in the post-war period, the nationalist movements would lead to the independence of Indonesia in 1949, Burma and Malay Federation in 1948, and the Philippines in 1946. There wasn't really an independence movement in the Philippines. Just remember that the Americans had promised the Philippines their independence 30 years from 1916. So in 1916, the Americans said, okay, after 30 years of occupation, we'll give you your independence. And that's what they did. In 1946, they gave the Philippines their independence. B, the struggle for independence in Africa. So 1, in post-war France, the French government was determined to hold on to its African nation of Algeria. And this region had a substantial French settler population. They had vineyards, oil and gas fields. And it wasn't until 1954 that a huge Algerian revolt would break out. And this was pursued with huge brutality by both sides. But would end up with French withdrawal and Algerian independence in 1962. So this was a pretty violent interaction between these two. A lot of deaths, a lot of confrontation. Section 2. None of the several wars in sub-Saharan Africa matched the Algerian struggle in scale, but even though there was not war, like a physical war, the new state suffered from a variety of problems, and these would include arbitrarily drawn borders, overdependence on export crops, lack of national road and railroad networks, and just general overpopulation. Section 3. Some of the politicians who would lead the nationalist movements devoted their lives to ridding their homelands of foreign occupations, like completely getting rid of Europeans. So we have two examples. We have Kwame, who was the independence leader and president of Ghana. And then we have Jomo Kenyatta, who would negotiate the independence and become the first president of the Republic of Kenya. 4. So African leaders in sub-Saharan French colonies were at first reluctant to call for independence because they realized that some of the colonies had very bleak economic prospects, and because they were aware of the importance of the billions of dollars of revenue from the French public, they were uneasy with necessarily going through with it. But nevertheless, the French colonies did achieve independence between 1958 and 1916. Section 5. Decolonization overall in Africa often involved huge struggles as people of European descent fought against the indigenous Africans in an attempt to retain their personal privileges, the control of resources, and of course political power. Race conflict was particularly severe in the southern part of Africa, including the Portuguese colonies of Angola and Mozambique, and the British colony of southern Rhodesia or Zimbabwe, and in South and Southwest Africa. C. The quest for economic freedom in Latin America. 1. So in Latin America, we saw those independent movements, specifically in Argentina, Brazil, Mexico from the last chapter. But their independence from European rule was achieved earlier. Remember, all the way back with the independence movements in the early 1800s. But we do see huge American and European dependence, or at least economic domination, even still after that into the 20th century. 2. So in Mexico, we do see the revolutionary rhetoric of the ruling institutional revolutionary party. And this was occupied by a very large and persistent disparity or gap between the rich and the poor, the urban and the rural inhabitants. So in Guatemala, we have President Guzman. He attempts to expropriate the property of those large landowners. So taking the property of the large landowners, including the fruit owning companies, and giving it to the people. And what ends up happening is it prompts the United States and the CIA to assist in a military coup that would initially remove Guzman from power and condemn Guatemala to decades and decades of political instability and violence. So in Guatemala, when a new leader, when the president tries to spread and share the land from large landowners and, of course, American fruit growers, the Americans get really mad and then basically cause decades of political instability by removing Arbenz or Guzman from power. Three. So in the 1950s, we do see in Cuba, remember the leader Batista, he was a general, he was a terrible person. I'm not saying Batista was a great leader, he was super terrible, but he was super corrupt, he was very repressive, he was very authoritarian, and what ends up happening is in 1959, Fidel Castro leads a very popular revolution that would force Batista to leave the country. Castro would redistribute the land, lower urban rents, raise wages, and seize the property of the U.S. and Cuban corporations. So we see the creation of communism and socialism into Cuba. But this isn't necessarily good because under Castro, the people actually hurt just as much, if not worse, than they were under Batista. Four. There is little evidence that Castro actually undertook his revolution to install a communist government, but we do see that faced with a U.S. blockade, he turned to the Soviet Union. So initially, it may not have been his ultimate goal to be a communist country, but the situation that was presented to him with the kind of face-off with the U.S., who else was he going to turn to? Cuba is a smaller country compared to the United States. They needed a powerful ally, so Castro turns to the Soviet Union for economic aid, and this commits him to communism and socialism and dependence on the Soviet Union. So in April of 1961, we see some 1,500 Cuban exiles who the CIA had personally trained land in the Bay of Pigs in Cuba in an attempt to overthrow Castro, but it was a failed attempt, and this is partly because the United States did not supply all the air support that the plan had called for, and so it kind of just fell apart. D, the challenges of nation building. One, so as decolonization occurred during this period on a huge scale and led to the establishment and creation of dozens of new nations between 1945 and 1965. Many of these new nations had to establish some form of government, and most of them had to do so while facing these huge, severe economic challenges. Two, many of the new nations also had to address serious educational concerns, including questions such as which language to teach, how to inculcate a sense of national unity in places where it had previously never existed, and they also had to provide satisfying jobs for their graduates. So the new nations were rarely really able to surmount these hurdles, and many nations, even those as successful as South Korea, they ended up opting for authoritarian rule. Section 3, Beyond a Bipolar World, A, the Third World. 1. So in 1955, we see that Indonesia's president, Sukarno, hosted a meeting of 29 African and Asian countries in Indonesia. And this meeting marked the beginning of an effort of the many newly poor and mostly non-European nations that emerged from decolonization to gain more political weight in the world. So what they decided to do was band together in what became known as the Non-Aligned Movement, or the Third World. Two, leaders of the so-called Third World countries preferred the label Non-Aligned, but we do see as the movement had the sympathy of the Soviet Union and included communist countries such as China and Yugoslavia, the West did not take the term Non-Aligned seriously. They instead continued to call them Third World. Three. So for the movement's leaders, the Non-Aligned was primarily a way of extracting money and support from one or both of the superpowers. One example of this is the ability of the Egyptian leader Nasser and Sadat to play the two superpowers against each other in order to get assistance in hydroelectric projects, arms, and loans from both sides. Section B, Japan and China. One, so at this time, both Japan and China were able to take advantage of the superpowers' preoccupation with the Cold War. So remember, the superpowers are the USSR and America. 2, the American occupation of Japan from 1945 to 1952, which is actually not that long at all, it's only 7 years, gave Japan a constitution. It allowed the country only a limited self-defense force and banned the deployment of Japanese troops abroad. So Japanese troops could only protect Japan. They couldn't go elsewhere. So the Japanese ended up staying out of the Cold War, and they concentrated on building up their industries and engaging in world commerce and gradually developing new markets in Southeast Asia. So the Japanese government aided Japanese business in the developing 3 industries that would be crucial to Japan's emergence as an economic superpower after 1975. Those 3 industries are electricity, steel, and shipbuilding. Section 3. So China was one of the countries that was deeply involved in Cold War politics. Remember, it is a communist country. And it being allied and aiding the Soviet Union in the 1950s, they were definitely not an ally of the United States. The People's Republic of China and the Soviet Union began to diverge in 1956. And we see that Mao would introduce his own radical policies, and one would be the disastrous policy of the Great Leap Forward in 1958, as well as the Cultural Revolution, which started in 1966. So the Great Leap Forward was this collectivization of communal farm, as well as this huge push for industrialization of China. The Cultural Revolution basically is the trying to stamp out all cultural identity of China. So getting rid of Chinese traditions, traditional Chinese literature or religion or anything. So anything that was traditionally Chinese, Mao wanted to get rid of it so that they could all follow one doctrine and not a variety of regional doctrines that was traditional to China prior. The rift between the People's Republic of China and the Soviet Union would widen, and it would be so wide that Nixon was able to actually establish a pretty good relationship between the U.S. and China in the early 1970s, and Nixon would be the first American president to go to China since forever. He's the first president to go to China. No president has gone to China before, but especially since China became communist. It was like opening the doors between China, and the opening of China really goes toward Richard Nixon. If Nixon is known for anything good, it is opening the relations with China. So C, the Middle East. As the Arabian states began gaining their independence from the Europeans, specifically the English, in the post-war years, we do see a struggle with Israel come to overshadow most Arab politics. 2, after World War II, there was an intense pressure to resettle European Jewish refugees, and this forced the British to turn to the Palestine question. And this would be turned over to the United Nations General Assembly. And on November of 1947, they voted to partition Palestine into 2 states, one Jewish and one Arab. Israel declared its independence in May of 1948 and defeated the Palestinian and other Arab forces that attempted to crush the newborn state. So we do see that with this, not pressure, but this move to transfer European Jewish people to the Middle East, the Europeans again will be causing international chaos, regional chaos, like they usually do when they go anywhere in the world. Section 3. In a 6-day war in 1967, Israel would take Arabian lands, including East Jerusalem, the West Bank, Golan Heights, and the Gaza Strip, as well as the Sinai Peninsula. Then we see the PLO, or the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which was headed by Yasser Arafat, would wage guerrilla war against Israel and engaged in acts of terrorism. This still is continuing to today. 4. So we do see the growing demand for oil in the post-war era, and this would prompt the oil-producing Arab states to form OPEC, or the Organization of oil exporting countries. And this would take effect in 1960. So OPEC embargoed the United States and the Netherlands for their support of Israel during the Arab-Israeli War of 1972. And it would end up quadrupling oil prices in 1974. So this is why we see in the United States the oil crisis in the 70s. So yeah, this is why if you ever look up 1970s gas crisis or oil crisis, how you'll see like black and white pictures or sometimes colored pictures of hundreds and hundreds of cars like in line waiting to get gas, was because the Arab nations, who are these huge oil producers, were refusing to even send or hugely limited the amount of oil and gas that they were sending to the United States. So that's why we see this gas crisis, and you'd have to wait in long, long lines, or you'd have to get up super early in the morning to go wait in line to get gas. So it wasn't life-threatening, but it was more of a nuisance to the United States, if anything. So D, the emergence of environmental concerns. So one, the Cold War had tremendous economic recovery power, and it focused on public and government attention on technological innovation and industrial projects. But only a few people really warned that technologies and industrial growth were actually causing harm to the environment. And one such person was Rachel Carson. Rachel Carson was, I want to say she was an American marine biologist, but she is a marine biologist. Yeah, she is. She's an American marine biologist, and she basically wrote this book called Silent Spring, and it talked about all the negative impacts, specifically on animals and marine animals, and how the environmental damage was affecting them. So she did talk about, I know one example she discusses in her book is something about the change in how the shell of birds, of marine birds, formed. So originally, you know, it's a shell, it's hard, but we see that due to environmental degradation, that the softening of shells, which is actually detrimental to the actual baby birds inside because they have a lower chance of survival. So she's just explaining different examples of how, what the environmental impact is of the Cold War. Two, we also see that in the late 60s, due to student protests in the United States, France, Japan, and Mexico, a rising of youth activism, and a lot of it focused on environmental problems. So this is around the time that we get the first Earth Day initiated, more people being green, more people looking towards recycling, the invention of recycling, really making it big and making it into the mainstream. So that's the end of chapter 31 and the end of Cold War and decolonization. We will continue on the next chapter, which will be chapter 32, the end of the Cold War, in the following week, and the changes of economic development and immigration up until the millennium. So we're moving right along. So we only have two more chapters and then we're done. Okay, so I'll see you in chapter 32.